Next case is 00408, State of Ohio versus Kevin L. Smith. Mr. Cicero.
Chief Justice and Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, Kevin Cicero on behalf of the Appellant Magasor, Kevin L. Smith, I'd like to reserve about 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
I was asked this Court to find that the sufficientless government demands C1's papers are outrageous, are in outrageous interference with the free citizens of Ohio.
Mr. Cicero, let me stop you with a threshold question. As I would guess you probably know, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Indianapolis versus Edmond last month. Neither of you filed supplemental authority or additional authority. Is that because you don't think it has any bearing on this case?
No, Your Honor. I believe the appellees did file a...
Did they?
Okay. That is part of the record, and that we do believe it does have some impact on this case. But we, Edmonds, obviously, decided under the Fourth Amendment, and we feel that this Court should decide this case under Section 14, Article 1 of the Ohio Constitution. But even if this Court is to look at the specifics of the incident case, in conjunction with the Fourth Amendment law, Appellants asked this Court to reinstate the trial court's decision, which did apply the appropriate balancing test under Fourth Amendment law. Because the Court of Appeals gave little to no consideration to the Ohio Constitution and never imposed the balancing test in accordance with the Fourth Amendment law, we would ask this Court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. There are several reasons why license checkpoints under the Ohio Constitution should be deemed repugnant to Article 1, Section 14. First off, it is a suspicionless seizure. It is a seizure without any indication of any criminal wrongdoing of any kind whatsoever. In 1802, when Ohio did in fact adopt its Constitution and an amendment which eventually was changed into the current language, which mirrors the Fourth Amendment, the language that existed in 1802 specifically addressed and used the phrase unwarrantable searches and seizures, specifically condemned general warrants. And general warrants in revolutionary times were not only used on houses, but also upon seizures of the person as well. And the 1802 language of the Ohio Constitution specifically listed that and talked about the fact that the seizure of the person should not be subject to a general warrant as well. Appellants submit that a suspicionless checkpoint is exactly that. It is nothing other than a general warrant. And if this Court is to interpret the Ohio Constitution in a manner in which the founders of it intended, we would submit that the Ohio Constitution condemns the suspicionless checkpoint at issue in this case.
Would it be fair to say that... Excuse me, go ahead.
What is so intrusive about stopping a motor vehicle to see whether the person has a driver's license? Most people don't feel that that would be intrusive, that they have a license, they show it, and they're on their way. What's so intrusive? Why should this be such a horrible thing and stopped?
With all due respect, Your Honor, we disagree. We believe that the citizens of Ohio do find this extraordinarily intrusive. Specifically in conversations with friends of mine, who these are people that would maybe like to get away with due process, and every time a police officer arrests someone, that person is automatically guilty. Even people like that, they come up with their most authoritarian, imperialistic impression of a show me your papers, give me your, show me your walking papers that you see in movies that talk about totalitarian regimes, and they find it very offensive that in the United States of America that this thing can be allowed to occur. I would respect to disagree, but when you talk about what is so intrusive about this seizure, you need to address it both in objective terms and in subjective terms, subjective and objective.
Well, to 12% of the people that were stopped in the Dayton area didn't have a license.
That is unclear from the record, Your Honor.
Isn't that keeping people who are unlicensed and dangerous, possibly unable to drive properly off the street and would endanger the rest of the people that are on the street with a license?
If we could say that that was the case, then you would probably be correct, Your Honor. However, we cannot say that that's the case. Despite the fact that countless officers were at these checkpoints, there were no records as to who was issued a citation for driving without a license, or driving with under some sort of suspension, or driving with some other defect to their driver's license. The records certainly weren't maintained.
I recognize you keep arguing about the record because it isn't the record, isn't in the record, but I read with interest Judge Young's dissent. Doesn't it fall, and doesn't your argument fail, if you concede, and do you, that licensed drivers cause more accidents than unlicensed drivers?
If that were to be the case...
And we know that, don't we?
I would submit that we don't.
We don't?
There was absolutely nothing presented by the state. In fact, they argued to the Second District that they didn't need to present anything.
I recognize the argument. It's not in the record. What I'm saying is, don't we just know that out of 100 accidents, 75 or 80 of them are going to have people that are licensed drivers? I mean, all you got to do is look at the police reports, and we know that. Let's just assume that for argument for a moment.
Okay.
Doesn't it make it impossible to show that this is not a safety issue, or is a safety issue, by showing that unlicensed drivers cause more accidents? Because you can't ever get to that, because you don't, unless you apprehend people that don't have licenses, you never know.
If I understand correctly, so if we didn't do a checkpoint, only by doing a checkpoint will we find out whether or not there's many people.
So we're going to find the unlicensed drivers.
I
recognize that it's an intrusion. My real question is, some time ago, a majority of this court decided that it was not an unreasonable intrusion on a minor for the police to take the minor down to the police station and fingerprint the minor, who was suspected of making pipe bombs, and it was just a routine inconvenience, but it was not an unreasonable seizure. Why wouldn't this be the same?
I do believe in that case there was specific facts relating to that minor child.
They had a couple people that said he was around school talking about pipe bombs.
And we don't contest the fact that a couple people say, hey, this person driving that car doesn't have a license, the police can't stop us. That's an entirely different situation from what we have here. The degree of intrusion in Baghdad is much different than a DUI checkpoint, because at a DUI checkpoint, you're merely observed. Your eyes are looked at, they smell whether or not you have an odor of alcohol on you, they look for other visible signs of inebriation on the actual person. When you ask for a person's personal identifying information, that moves this up a couple of notches into a much more intrusive search. Finally, another reason why this court should decide this case under the Ohio Constitution in Appellant's favor is that this court has established a rule that it should interpret its Ohio Constitution, Article 1, Section 14, in a manner that is consistent with the Fourth Amendment. However, unless there is a caveat to that, unless there are persuasive reasons to do otherwise, I certainly don't believe this court would adopt the rule in which, in all circumstances, the Ohio Constitution must mirror the Fourth Amendment. We submit that there are very persuasive reasons in this case why this court should vary and decide this case under the Ohio Constitution, the reasons that I've just mentioned.
If we do that, should we disregard the observation in Prowse by the U.S. Supreme Court that in the absence of other information that we would assume that unlicensed drivers are less safe than licensed drivers?
Absolutely.
We should disregard that.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Why should we do that?
Because even in SITS, in the Prowse case, SITS was authored by Chief Justice Rehnquist. Chief Justice Rehnquist, in the Prowse case, wanted random suspicionless stops in that case. But even in the SITS case, the gravity of the situation was clearly documented in the record. Statistics were cited in SITS that talked about the fatalities, the DUIs caused, was equaling the number of casualties on battlefields. Those were the type of statistics that they had in SITS. Clearly, the situation is much different when you're talking about unlicensed drivers, and in the incident case, we have, in fact, no evidence in the record to establish that the situation is equivalent, anyway, even equivalent to that of DUIs. The appellees have decided on appeal to try to present new evidence, and in the second part of our reply brief, we have done the limited amount of attack that is available to us there, and we believe have established that the appellees, in their new statistics, have shown nothing more than that 1 in 8 drivers is unlicensed, and that 1 in 8 drivers that gets into an accident is unlicensed. That certainly indicates that unlicensed drivers are no more a threat than the licensed drivers.
For you to win, do we have to decide this under Article 1, Section 14 of the Ohio Constitution? And thereby, because of the Supreme Court's recent pronouncement?
They certainly have tacitly stated that they would tacitly approve of...
That it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. They have certainly have dicta now planted in several of their cases stating that they would uphold it. We feel, though, that if they did do a balancing test and did it with some teeth, then they would not allow driver's licenses checkpoints to exist. And let me talk about that a little bit. And that's one of the reasons that we asked to go under the Ohio Constitution. The initial first time in history that we have upheld a suspicionless stop checkpoint of this kind was in Martinez Fuerte case. In that case, it was a permanently fixed checkpoint. Then several years later, in 1990, we have the SITS case, which is a temporary checkpoint. The senators in the SITS case noted that clearly they thought the majority did not explain how such a scheme fit within the Fourth Amendment. However, the balancing test is not applied in a balancing fashion. The gravity existed in SITS. There was severe gravity. The casualties that equal those we see on balance. However, in the second aspect of the explosive balance, the second leg of this balancing test, the degree to which the seizure advances the public interest, they did nothing. There was no concern on their part whatsoever to the extent that this somehow advanced the interest.
And but certainly you must concede that they knew about the balancing test when they put that dicta in their opinions.
Certainly they did.
And if we said, oh, we don't think you really mean what you said in your opinion, even though it's dictum, you may want to do that. I don't.
We don't think that it would be appropriate for us to ask you to overturn what the United States Constitution United States Supreme Court.
Well, we can't. We can't overturn it.
Yeah,
right. It'd be a futile act on your part.
If this case does go any further, we will certainly advance what Justice Thomas stated in his dissenting opinion in the Indianapolis v. Edmunds case, that certainly the founders did not contemplate this type of suspicionless checkpoint stop as being valid. So, but we think when you look at what they have done in several different contexts, Mr. Chief Justice, do I need to stop now?
Hey, you have a little less than 2 minutes. Your white light's on, so.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Cicero. Ms. Logan. Logan, could you speak up just a little? We have a little.
Sure.
Okay.
Regarding Section 14, Article 1.
You're inviting a question before you start. I'm curious, and I hunted and hunted. Is there any scientific, any logical, other than possible discriminatory motives for picking the locations of these sites?
The locations were selected by the Grand Staff State Police Department. And in making those selections, they wanted to make sure that checkpoints were throughout the city. There were several checkpoints in different districts in the city. The command staff decided the specific locations based on the problems that the city had. According to the guidelines submitted for the checkpoint, at that point in time, Dayton had 30% of the citations written for people who did not have valid licenses. They believed that this was a severe problem in Dayton. Based on that, the guidelines were established and the checkpoints conducted. The checkpoints weren't discriminatory. The locations of the checkpoints weren't discriminately made. They were based on information obtained in the by the city Dayton Police Department and their knowledge of what was going on within the city in terms of proper locations.
So what we're going to do is say they were targeted areas. That's a... Okay, I understand. It bothers me because we do this to people who can have the least ability to fight back. And that bothers me, but go ahead.
As it relates to the appellant argument under Section 14, Article 1 of the state constitution, we believe that State v. Williams is controlling in this matter. In State v. Williams, the court specifically stated that Section 14, Article 1 is not self-executing, and that it's policy, that it's a policy statement, that there's no force unless there was independent legislation. So therefore, the appellant's argument that instead of deciding this case under U.S. Constitution, that the Ohio Constitution should be applied.
Are you saying that the Fed section of the Constitution is essentially a dead letter then?
Yes.
Has no meaning?
No. What I'm saying is that Section 14, Article 1 is the identical language in the U.S. Constitution. That unless, as stated by the appellant, unless there's some persuasive reason that there wouldn't be any stricter requirements placed on Section 14, Article 1. And in this particular situation, it's either there that the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is controlling. The case law in the United States Constitution is clearly held that driver's license checkpoints would be valid under the Fourth Amendment. And it was recently clarified in Indianapolis versus Edmonds. And Indianapolis versus Edmonds dealt with an illegal drug checkpoint, but the court was clear when it discussed Sykes, when it discussed Martinez, and when it discussed the recognition made in Crown that driver's license checkpoint does satisfy a vital state interest, and that state interest being that the road is safe.
Would that be the case under all of, in case of all the precedent that's lying out there that you consider to be on your side? Does it all support this kind of activity? If the activity is, if there's evidence that the activity is all targeted to neighborhoods where there also happens to be high crime profiles, low economic neighborhoods, that none of these checkpoints are neighborhoods. Do those cases still all show up? The constitutionality of
if I understand what you're saying, what you're asking is that whether or not the checkpoints are used for target areas to target those individuals, would that also be constitutional?
Right.
I would think that that would go to the operation of the checkpoint, and that would be a separate issue that would have to be determined.
Okay, so it would not be fair to say that the existing case law would necessarily bless checkpoints that when you look at all the evidence here to be a ruse or a guise for doing something else, namely interdicting drugs.
Correct, Your Honor. And then in the analysis, the court stated they believe that that the illegal drug checkpoint is violating the Fourth Amendment. So if the purpose itself is illegal, then that would be a separate.
So if you call it driver's license checkpoints, but the operational impact becomes clear, the objective is something more than just checking driver's licenses, it would then be constitutionally suspect.
If the operation is not what appears to be on its face, that would require.
Was there any kind of record established on those kinds of questions in this case?
The record indicates that the only purpose for this, for Dayton operations, because Dayton recognized that they had a problem with unlicensed drivers and they created a risk on the road. The record also indicates that at this point in time, 30% of the citations issued by Dayton were because of some violation of your driving record. You didn't have a valid driver's license for some reason.
Okay, was there anything in the record indicated that these checkpoints had ever been run in affluent neighborhoods of Dayton?
The record indicates that the police department went through a great deal of effort to make sure that every district in the city of Dayton, a checkpoint operation was operated and at a location where there was a problem. A specific area was never targeted.
Okay, I don't think you answered the question. Was there anything in the record that indicated there were any checkpoints ever run in affluent neighborhoods?
My response to that, Your Honor, is that the term affluent neighborhoods was never used. And how that question was phrased is that every district in the city of Dayton
I don't know how your districts are made up. It could be that every district has affluent and impoverished neighborhoods.
It would include many socioeconomic neighborhoods. It would include the poor neighborhoods, the middle class neighborhoods, the upper middle class neighborhoods, if every district in the city of Dayton had a checkpoint. It was across the board. But the checkpoint operated by the city of Dayton is consistent with the case with the existing case law of the U.S. Supreme Court. We satisfy the balancing test. The interest served by the government is established. Crowds recognize the state, in fact, has a vital interest in making sure that the roadways are safe. Indianapolis and the evidence most recently clarified that is exactly what Brown stated, that this is recognized across the board that this is a vital government interest. That driver's license checkpoint to apprehend unlicensed drivers. So the crime is committed when you get behind the wheel of a car and you don't have a valid license. At those checkpoints, that is determined, that crime is determined.
Are there any questions? One of the questions we're asked, you have to, I assume you have to offer proof of insurance, or is, are the checkpoints also looking for uninsured motorists?
The only goal of Dayton checkpoint was to determine whether or not the person had a valid driver's license. In our particular case, once an automobile was stopped, an officer asked for your driver's license and registration. If the driver's license was submitted to the officer and it was valid on its face, you were free to go.
And no question of insurance. I thought every stop now routinely, every traffic stop in Ohio, this is sort of a statute now requires you to carry with you proof of insurance.
Currently is.
And provide that.
Currently is required that proof of insurance be shown. These checkpoints were operated in 1998 prior to that particular change in the law. And how this checkpoint was operated, that the officers asked for a license to see your driver's license. If you produced one, you were free to go, and that took approximately 45 seconds. If you did not produce a license, or you produced a license that was not valid on the state, you were held in order for the officers to verify whether on their cruisers came to determine whether their license was in fact valid. In that situation, the checkpoint staff operated by the city of Dayton, 224 citations issued for invalid driver's license of some sort. Many people received multiple citations, and some people were arrested for warrants, but the majority of the, those citations were for unlicensed drivers. So it's clear that the checkpoint operations were affected. They were able to discover unlicensed drivers that would not have been discovered in any other method after some other incident, such as a traffic accident.
Counsel, let me take this one step further. We find it this constitution. We have a case which was argued here recently involving the officers who, for a traffic stop, ask people out of their car for routine traffic stops, and then ask them to come back to the cruiser, and then they feel they need for personal security to pat them down to put them in the cruiser. When you combine all of that, is that authorized? Would this routine driver's license stop, would you, if you don't have a driver's license, is the process, invite them back to the cruiser, pat them down, before placing the cruiser?
Are you asking, was that our process, or would
yes.
that process be proper? That was not our process.
Would that process be allowed?
I would submit that once you fail to give a driver's license or a license that's not valid in the state, that raises the bar, that there is a reasonable suspicion at that point that you are driving without a license, but it would not require that person to leave their car at that point to go to a cruiser or a pat down for officer safety. I would think that goes too far. In fact, the Dayton checkpoint didn't do that at all. There was no search. No one was removed from their car unless they were being arrested for driving without a valid license.
Okay, if they were arrested for driving without a valid license, then they were placed in the cruiser.
But none of that occurred while the process was going on. It was after it was determined that this person was behind the wheel of a car without a license.
And you're not just given a citation for something like that. You're cuffed and taken down to the hospital.
Driving without a license for most driving without license offenses are first-degree misdemeanors, which are generally.
So you are taken down?
Yeah.
You are taken down to the police station if you have a license.
Let me ask you a question that was raised by Mr. Cicero's argument. He's arguing, as you know, that we apply the state constitution, and although the language is there's no difference in the substance of the language, you would agree, would you not, that we as a state Supreme Court can apply our own constitutional provision more strictly than the U.S. Constitution does? That is, more strictly against the government. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that more restrictive regulations could be placed for persuasive reasons. I submit that in this particular case there are no persuasive reasons, and that the U.S. Supreme Court precedent is what controls the matter.
Well, just so I understand, we don't have to be persuaded by the U.S. Supreme Court in any way, do we? And if we're interpreting our own constitution, same language as U.S. Supreme Court, we can find different reasons than we can find reasons that depart from the rationale of U.S. Supreme Court cases to apply our same language more strictly. In other words, to give citizens more protection against police power. Can we not? Okay. Looks like you've used your time.
Thank you,
Ms. Logan. Mr. Cicero, you've saved a little over a half a minute of your time.
Thank you. I'd like to clear up one thing when Ms. Logan referred to the nature of the sound, just by this question. It was not simply a showing a license that is valid on its face. They also then ran that person's information through their onboard computers and their cruisers to find out if this person had anything else wrong with them. Several people, that's part of the reason why we can't determine how many people were arrested for driving without a license, because many people were arrested for outstanding warrants for unrelated matters. So the intrusiveness of this stop went well beyond someone just showing a picture with identifying information. Also, they ran your information to see what else the government knew about this particular person.
So you weren't just flashing your license if the photo.
Absolutely not.
You weren't free to go.
Absolutely not. They ran that information through the computer to find out if you had anything else that you were doing wrong.
I see counsel on the other side.
Is that in the
shaking their head?
That's
so.
Is that in the record?
We do.
We'll find that in the record.
The records indicate, Justice Thompson indicated, many people were arrested for outstanding warrants unrelated to the matter.
Unrelated meaning that the person did have a valid driver's license, but through leads or whatever they found that they were wanted for something else.
Exactly. So, I see my time is up.
Yes, thank you. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion. The next case is 00495, State of Ohio versus Audrey Iacona. Let me ask you a factual question. It seems
sure.
to me that the one of the problems here with, on that issue is that are autopsies of this nature routinely sent from Edina County to the Cuyahoga County Coroner? Is that how this, I mean, this is what happened here, I guess. Is that?
That's what happened here. I don't know what the routine is, okay. But this one was far back to Cuyahoga County. But it was the Medina County coroner who was charged by law with the responsibility for determining the manner of death, who so testified in the juvenile court, and the law required that all of the documents relative to the autopsy be filed in his office. So all the way from the juvenile court to the sentencing, where the court sentenced Audrey to 8 years, first offender to 8 years, on the ground that was half her life up to the time she got pregnant. Now, the real issue in this case never got tried, and that was whether the cause of the death was Streptococcus A infection or asphyxia resulting from Audrey's crime. And the reason it didn't get tried is either because the prosecutor didn't timely disclose the report, or because defense counsel failed to render effective assistance to counsel in failing to investigate and use it.
Counsel, they claimed that they sent you a copy of this report along with other things. I assume you would deny that.
Well, they didn't send it to me. I wasn't trial counsel, Your Honor.
All right.
They testified that they had sent it to trial counsel.
They faxed it. I think they said one place they faxed it and they sent someone over to the office.
That was their testimony.
With copies of these reports. Did that happen?
Well, that was their testimony. Defense counsel testified it did not. It did not.
So you never received from the prosecutor any copies of any reports that about this situation?
Well, the defense counsel testified that they never received the blood culture test, which was the evidence of Streptococcus A infection of the baby's blood.
And when was it the first time that they discovered there was a report?
They first discovered there was a report at the time of the testimony of the last or next to last defense witness, Dr. Mehta, who in the course of his cross-examination by the prosecutor made an observation that there was no blood culture had been done. And the prosecutor then sought to impeach that by presenting him with Trial Exhibit 77, which was the blood culture report, at which time both defense counsel promptly asserted that they had never seen it.
So at that time, the prosecutor had a copy of that report?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Is it a matter of fact that you get reports from the coroner's office in every case, defense counsel?
I can't.
Are you able to subpoena those records and reports?
There's nothing in the record about what one gets from the what one gets in every case from the coroner's office. I know that in this case, many requests were made by the defense counsel. They never got. They testified that they never got the coroner's report.
Request of who?
What?
You said many requests were made. Who were the
to
requests?
To the coroner's office, to the prosecutor.
Oh, they requested them from the coroner's office also. And they were refused copies of, and they think they...
They weren't refused, they just didn't get the blood culture test. Now, the court found, the court that heard the new trial motion hearing found that the evidence was equally balanced on the issue of whether or not the report had been produced. And therefore, concluded that since we assigned us the burden of proof, although we've argued in our brief that on compliance with Brady, the burden of proof should be on the state, but nevertheless, because we had the burden of proof, therefore, for purposes of the hearing, the new trial court assumed that the report had been provided.
So was there a finding made then that in that hearing that the prosecutor did provide a report to the defense counsel?
Based on an evenly divided evidence, yes. That is the new trial court's conclusion.
For material to be Brady material, must it be in writing or be a tangible object?
Not necessarily.
For instance, they have the test and no report, is it Brady material?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
They have the test, they know of the infection, but it's never in a report, a written report. Is that still Brady material?
Oh, yes, it's not only Brady material, it is Rule 16 material under this court's decision in State versus Wilson, where there was an oral conclusion about a report that had been discussed with the prosecutor that wasn't communicated, and this court held it was a violation of Brady and Rule 16.
There's some indication here, and this is what the case turns on for me, Mr. Schwartz, that the baby was in fact born alive because the autopsy showed air.
Yes.
How do you answer that?
Well, the coroner who testified at the preliminary hearing testified that the baby took at least one, and concluded the baby took at least one breath and maybe more. Mm-hmm. The streptococcus A doesn't necessarily result in a birth of a dead baby. The testimony of our experts was that it can and frequently does result in death within a few minutes of birth. So the fact that the baby took a few breaths isn't inconsistent with streptococcus A defense.
Could
have. There was testimony to that effect that infection acts so quickly that if the baby would be dead within a few minutes?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
On that issue, Mr. Schwartz,
testimony by Drs. Blankhorn and Kirshner, yeah, in the new trial here.
Could it be a crime for someone in Ms. Iacona's situation to give birth to a baby in the basement rather than go to a hospital? Her mother was a nurse. Call 911. Her friends apparently knew she was pregnant. They were concerned about the baby. Some testimony, they were more concerned than she was about it. Could she be at least accused of committing a crime for giving birth to a baby? Say there is strep, and the baby has a slight chance of living. As I read the briefs, it seemed to me that under exigent care in a proper hospital the baby could live, even if you were correct, even if the evidence would show that there really was strep in the baby's body, which I don't think we know. But could that be the source of a crime, do you think?
Well, of course, she doesn't know that the baby has strep.
Right, right.
I don't think it would be a crime the fact that she gave birth at home. Now, the Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction for manslaughter on the ground that the streptococcus A evidence didn't establish the probability,
yeah,
that the baby wouldn't have survived if she had rendered a call for help earlier. But the Court of Appeals relied on the Lucas Intermediate Court of Appeals decision in Lucas from Alabama, which has subsequently been reversed by the Alabama Supreme Court, which says that the state has the burden of proving that the baby died because the mother failed to call for help. Namely, that had she made the call, the baby could have been saved. And the evidence on that the defense experts testified that was not the case, and the state's experts didn't testify on that because, number one, they denied the existence of streptococcus A, and number two, their testimony contemplated the baby being treated within minutes after birth by a team of a hospital team with sophisticated equipment. That would not be the case here. The evidence is such that the state would have the burden of proof and they didn't carry it. At the very least, you certainly have created a huge question of reasonable doubt, and we believe a substantial case for the proposition that the baby's death was caused by streptococcus A.
Let me ask you why, because your time is running, and you both get more time if we need it, but I voted to bring the case in because of the Brady issue, frankly, and so I'd like to hear a little more argument on the law of Brady and the subsequent cases. Why does Galt not make it a difficult case for you? The Galt case.
The what case?
The Galt. G-A-U-L-T?
The juvenile court case?
Yes.
Well, because it doesn't really address the question of whether the state is required to produce exculpatory evidence that would totally undermine the whole theory of the state's case. If I could read to you the trial court's summary, it's very brief, of the state's case at the middle of the trial, the Rule 29 motion. The court says, what the state has offered, to summarize, the state, as I understand the state of the evidence, what the state has offered is there's no other reason this baby died other than the lack of air and putting the baby in a plastic bag and having the bag rolled, so to speak, whatever was done at the top, as described by the first witness, who cut off the air supply, two plastic bags plus a top. Now, the injection of evidence of another reason for the baby to die dramatically changes the case from beginning to end. I'm advised my time is up if I wish to have any time for rebuttal, so I will defer the rest.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Salzgaber.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Joseph Salzgaber, assistant prosecuting attorney on behalf of Kelly Stable.
Counselor, is it unfair to say, in reading Dr. Rolfe's autopsy report, that he came to the conclusion to which he came by process of elimination?
That is correct.
All right. He says he finds nothing else, no marks on the baby and nothing else, and therefore I must conclude that the death occurred because of the plastic bag. Now, if he had had the other evidence, that is the evidence of the infection, might there have been, through his process of elimination, a break in that causal chain?
Well, I think that when you're talking about Dr. Kristen Rolfe, she was the Cuyahoga County coroner pathologist who actually performed the autopsy. Mm-hmm. She was aware of the blood culture report, and that was integrated into her findings as the cause of death. The Cuyahoga County coroner rejected blood culture as a meaningless contaminant, largely because simply looking at the document itself, the group A strep only grew in one of the two vials of blood, which is indicative of a contamination of the results of not infection. If there had been an infection, you would have seen growth in both vials of blood. If you're referring to Dr. Brad instead of the Cuyahoga and the Medina County coroner, he relied on the findings of the Cuyahoga County coroner's office because he is not a pathologist. I believe there was a question asked to Mr. Schwartz about whether autopsies and suspected homicides are sent out of Medina County, and that is the practice because of our coroner's office.
But didn't Dr. Rolfe testify, and I went over that pretty carefully, didn't she testify that in fact it was impossible to tell whether or not the baby was dead or alive when it was placed in the plastic bag?
That is correct. Based upon the evidence that she had, it wasn't clear, and in the context of the question it was the baby smothered before it was placed in the bag or did it die in the bag, and she indicated that that could not be determined. The appellant did not testify in this case or give her account of what happened in that basement, so we left visible findings.
Wasn't there other medical testimony about other physical signs the baby was exhibited
that there was a staph infection? Could you repeat that,
please? I think it was maybe in the new trial that there was testimony by the prosecution that if the baby in fact had this infection, there would be other physical evidence in the baby's body demonstrate the
signs
of infection, that there were
infections. That is correct. An examination of the body determined there was no infection in the baby, no infection in the remainder of the umbilical cord, and that there was no infection in the mother. If this had been an ascending infection, there would have been some sign of infection in her adrenal coma when she went to Medina Hospital that day. There would have been some sign of infection in the baby to support this blood culture. But as I indicated earlier, the group A strep only grew in one of the two vials of blood, which was indicative of contamination or non-infection.
Was there any testimony that conflicted with that testimony? Not the vials of blood, but the appearance of signs of the infection in the mother of the baby. There was conflicting, was there not?
That's correct, but that was the new trial motion bringing that to not occur trial. Following the...
Well, but that's still relevant, isn't it, to us, whether or not she was prejudiced by not having that testimony at the bindover hearing?
It would be relevant, however, visiting the judge appointed by this court, Judge Rubiano, found that there was no suppression of evidence, that it was blood culture was not used by the defense simply because there was contamination without a big difference.
How do you know that to the jury?
Well, the jury in this case actually heard the evidence that there was a positive blood culture result. Mr. Holman himself brought that out during his cross-examination of Dr. Meadow during the defense case in chief. And Dr. Meadow said this is significant. Then there was testimony from Dr. Chandler, the Cuyahoga County deputy coroner, chief deputy coroner, interpreting that for the jury as being a contamination. So the jury went in and found this Iacona guilty of involuntary manslaughter related offenses, knowing that there was a positive blood culture.
I think our legal issue here is the bindover hearing, is it not? What information was available to the judge at the time the judge makes the decision whether to bind the case to common pleas court, the general division? And if, let's assume that we didn't have a dispute over contamination of the blood sample and so forth, and it's revealed that indeed there was infection in the baby or in the mother, would that, and that evidence was available to the judge at the time of the bindover hearing, would that affect the probable cause, to believe the child committed the act charged?
No, I do not believe that it would. We're talking about...
Could it raise a doubt about it?
Could it raise a doubt, possibly, but it would not have affected the probable cause. I cited the state Rude out of Minnesota, which stands for the proposition that at the preliminary bindover hearing where the issue is probable cause, even if the defense presents evidence that is contradictory or even possibly exonerating, that did not necessarily affect the probable cause determination, where the state has sufficient evidence to get beyond a criminal Rule 29 motion for acquittal trial. And in this case, based upon the testimony of Appellant's own friends as to her purpose, based upon the testimony of the sheriff's detectives and Patrolman Domus, the Hinckley Police Department chief, continually lied for roughly an hour and a half trying to cover up the crime, and the fact that the coroner, Dr. Walt, and Dr. Gravis have testified that this was a lie for he had air in the lungs, in the stomach, and in the small bowel, that it takes roughly 3 to 6 minutes of effective breathing to get air into the small bowel, and the fact that the death was caused by insertion of plastic bag. Those facts, that testimony would not have changed even if the defense had presented the blood culture report at the finding of hearing. I would further note that the state provided the blood culture report pursuant to Criminal Rule 16 over 10 weeks prior to trial, as well as facts in hand delivered.
There was some question about whether it was legible, I guess, wasn't there?
That was raised by the defense. The cover sheet with regard to the blood culture report in the vitreous study, the cover sheet was a supplemental witness list which stated the name of K-May, Cuyahoga County Coroner's Office, and two attached lab reports. So if defense counsel couldn't read that, I believe they had a responsibility to ask for a clearer account. And furthermore...
Didn't the cover sheet say something about refer to DNA so that the defense counsel would think that it was about DNA rather than a blood test that had been taken on from the baby or the mother?
Well, the cover sheet, it says K-May, Cuyahoga County Coroner's Office, doesn't say anything about DNA. If that was their belief and they couldn't read it, then they should have requested a clearer copy. Furthermore, our copy would have been very similar to their copy, and we had no difficulty with that.
There's a dispute on whether or not they ever received this. Let's assume, just for purposes of argument, that we tend to believe that they didn't get it. on an abundance of caution. Would that change the outcome here?
No, it would not. In terms of Brady issue, it was readily available at the Pathfinder County Coroner's Office, and it was the receipts were signed indicating that their experts and attorney Mark Van looked at the contents of the files for their including laboratory findings, the blood culture report being a laboratory finding. If they somehow missed it and didn't use it, the fact that it was not material to the outcome of this case would have prevented it from being either a Brady violation or ineffective assistance of counsel or prejudice from.
So, in fact, it was available by proper discovery, by use of proper discovery.
That's correct. It was provided pursuant to Criminal Rule 16, and it was readily available for Brady purposes at the Pathfinder County Coroner's.
I had some feeling that some of the information wasn't promptly reduced or was not reduced to writing. Is that accurate?
No, that's a claim based on State v. Wilson that somehow the interpretation by Dr. Challenger, the chief deputy coroner of the blood culture report, should have been provided. However, the state's duty is not to explain what all these documents mean to the defendant, simply to provide them. We don't have to sit down and explain what every document means. That's what their experts are for.
So even if this was Brady material, and it wasn't turned over, your indication because of the pathology that it wouldn't make any difference anyway.
That's correct. That is correct. And even if you were to believe the claim by appellants that it would not have made a difference in any event. And that is because she was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Even if there was an infection in this baby, she had a duty of care, protection, and support to provide that baby with medical attention as soon as possible. Her own experts testified that there was a 75-85% possibility of survival, even with an actually infected newborn, if there was immediate medical attention.
Could she be charged for, Mr. Schwartz says she can't be charged for having a baby at home. That sounds like a pretty rational statement. Could she be charged for having the baby in the basement as she did? Let's assume there's no bag and no, she just had the baby at home and it died because it was infected and it didn't have the proper care. Could she be charged?
You could be charged with child endangerment, violating duty of care, protection, and support. This was a situation where she was in labor for most of the night. She called a friend on the telephone approximately 3 hours before giving birth, indicating that she was in labor and waiting for her parents to leave. So Audrey Iacona had really no intention of this child surviving. Sentencing bias on the part of Judge Kimbler, that is probably the most ridiculous of all the arguments on the violent defense. The reason provided by Judge Kimbler for an 8-year sentence was essentially a manifestation of his belief that a minimum 3-year sentence would demean the seriousness of this offense, talking about a helpless infant killed by his mother. It was only the fact that there was not the recitation of statutory language that resulted in a reversal on the sentence issue. The Court of Appeals was not required in this case to reduce or modify the sentence under revised Section 2953.08b as opposed to simply remanding the case.
Salskaver. Mr. Schwartz, you've saved a little over 3 minutes of your time.
Mr. Schwartz, what was the other testimony? The fact that there was no evidence of aggression in the child?
There was the Doctors Glencorn, Kirshner, and Tease, presented by the defense, testified that a fulminant infection can't take place or kill the baby before there's any show of cellular change in the body of the baby. And so there was head-on conflict on that issue, Your Honor.
Wouldn't there have to be subsequent change? I mean, once the, you may not have change on it immediately, but once the infection hits and kills, there has to be some change for the killing to happen.
Well, I can't quarrel with that, having no expertise, but I can tell you that, that the testimony of the defense experts was to the contrary. So there was a head-on conflict there.
Let's assume then that, that there was an infection. How would a 17-year-old know? I mean, there seems to be clear evidence, undisputed, that the baby drew breath. Even an infection would take a while to kill. How would a 17-year-old know that the baby was dead? There still was no conscious. And could the jury have even believed perhaps it was an infection, but that her act of failing to check with a child, putting a child in a trash bag and putting a child in a trash can, not knowing that it was truly an infection?
She described the baby at the hospital in a way that, without knowing the significance of it, in a way that her the defense experts testified would be what a Streptococcus A baby might look like and might appear to be dead even if they weren't. So
the whole point. So might appear to be dead and not be.
Well, but she.
Yet she goes ahead and trashes it.
Well, she believed it was dead. She didn't trash it. She wrapped it in. She wrapped it in towels and put it in a bag. Now, maybe that's not the kind of care we would most prefer. But it really isn't fair to equate this with trashing it or throwing it in a dumpster, like some of the other cases in the reported literature. And the fact is, there's head-on conflicts here, and those should be resolved by a jury or by the finder of fact or by Judge Heck in the juvenile court. And those issues would have been present. Had either the documents been produced or the defense considered and utilized them. And on the issue of materiality, although I would like to simply read to you briefly from your decision in State versus Johnson, we find our confidence in the trial court's verdict to be undermined by the state's failure to disclose evidence concerning the possibility that the murders may have occurred at a location other than Appley's farm, and the possibility that another person may have been responsible for the victim's death. This evidence is material because it tends to contradict the state's theory that Appley killed and dismembered the victim at his farm prior to transporting the body to the cornfield. While such evidence may appear to be of relatively minor importance in the total context of the case, such evidence may be sufficient to raise a reasonable doubt where the validity of the verdict is questionable, or whereas here, the verdict is based on circumstantial evidence. And here, the case is totally based on circumstantial evidence. With respect to the claim that it was produced with the K-May document, this exhibit D-5 is the K-May document. And it is a supplemental discovery document provided by the prosecutor with discovery reports. The other ones list the reports that are given. This one lists only K-May, Cuyahoga County Coroner's Office.
But it still remains that these documents were as available to the prosecution and to the defense equally. You could have gone to the coroner's office, got a copy of the reports, and you would have had them. Why do you have to depend solely? Don't you have an obligation to investigate your case and to go to the coroner's office and get all available reports yourself?
They did that, and they asked for the reports. They didn't get this report.
So they didn't. The coroner kept the reports from them also.
The coroner testified that they were put in a file and put on a file cabinet where they could have seen them.
I see. Okay.
And in light of the testimony that preceded this document, this was misleading and concealed the significance of the reports, because K-May had nothing to do with blood cultures. She had to do with DNA.
Do they make a distinction from you? You say that the culture that grew was Streptococcus A.
Yes.
They say it was a contamination.
Right.
There's a difference there, isn't there?
There's a huge difference.
Okay.
And that's a roaring difference that is a kind of an issue that a jury has to decide.
And you say that the culture specifically on page like 6 of your brief, I think, said, in this case, the blood taken from the baby's heart grew a pure strain of Streptococcus A.
Yes, in fact.
Is that disputed?
That's not disputed. And one of the tests, and if you look at the, compare the cross-examination of Dr. Challoner in trial with his cross-examination in the trial hearing when counsel were prepared to deal with it, he was unaware of the infectious disease test for determining contamination. One of the significant tests is, does it grow a pure strain or are there a multiple number of bugs? Because multiple bugs are more consistent with contamination. A pure strain is more consistent with infection. This grew a pure strain, and that was not disputed.
But that doesn't answer the question where it grew, when it was growing first, right?
What?
That doesn't answer the question when it began to grow. That's the issue.
It began to grow within 48 hours.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, but that doesn't answer the contamination question, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What caused it to grow? Was it in the baby's heart when it was withdrawn from it, or was it contaminated after it was withdrawn?
That's
from
the disputed
right.
issue.
Yeah.
And I can argue that why it was based on the testimony, why it was in the baby's heart, because it was a pure strain, because they used sterilized needles. Because they seared the heart before they put the needle in order to kill any infection, their witnesses said otherwise.
Said otherwise, the effect that Streptococcus A could grow from other contaminants.
That in fact it was a contaminant rather than something that had been in the baby's heart. That was the big disputed issue in the new trial hearing, which never got developed at trial because counsel were totally unprepared to deal with it, either because they didn't get the report or because they ignored it and didn't do anything and weren't prepared and therefore rendered ineffective assistance. It had to be one of the two. And the standard materiality is the same for both failure to produce Brady material and ineffective assistance.
You've used your time, Mr. Schwartz. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.